Welcome to Amazing Women. I'm Deb Ruggiero, host and creator of the radio show and the podcast, available on all your favorite streaming apps. So thank you for joining us. Rhode Island may be the smallest state in the country, but it has a huge role in American history. Rhode Island has a really rich, rich history with the French Canadians that settled in Blackstone Valley, the Museum of Work and Culture, to the John Brown House in Providence. And my guest is Morgan Greff, the executive director of the Rhode Island Historical Society. She's been at the society since 2005. She's a historian with a PhD in American Civilization from Brown University. Her publications include How Rhode Island's Lively Experiment Helped Chart the American Way. She makes her home in Pawtucket with her spouse, artist Paige Prentice. Morgan, so nice to see you again. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you're running the fourth oldest state historical society in the United States, founded in 1822. What do you love about your work at the Rhode Island Historical Society?
Well, I mean, I think the thing that keeps me here for 19 years is the fact that we do so much. You know, in many ways, every week I'm at four different organizations. I'm at our John Brown House Museum working with students, or we're up at the Museum of Work and Culture with a group from a senior center, or we're over with genealogists or researchers at our Robinson Research Center, or we're hosting a lecture here at our Aldrich House, our headquarters. And that just scratches the surface of the kind of work that we do, especially given the incredible work that we do with our Rhode Island teachers all over the state and our students. So the thing that I think many people don't know about the organization is how wide ranging it is, mm-hmm. and how many ways there are for you to connect with your history, the history of Rhode Island, and the history of Rhode Island is the history of the United States as well as the history of this world. We are this hub of immigration, this hotbed of exchange of cultural practices and ideas and traditions. And the richness of that is infused throughout not just the Rhode Island Historical Society's materials, but the fabulous historical societies, organizations, heritage organizations throughout the state.
Well said. The website is rihs.org. Now, you're a private organization, correct?
We are.
Okay. So how are you funded?
Our funding comes from a lot of different places. We have an endowment, which was established in the early part of the 20th century, which has helped us run and helped us really make it through things like the pandemic. We also, we do charge for entrance to our museums. It's a very small fee, and we're committed to keeping that fee low. And that's why it's so important that we have that funding from an endowment that we take a very prudent draw from every year to keep our operations going. We also then have fundraisers, and we have, importantly for us, as we were founded in 1822, since that time, we have been a membership organization. And so our members are a part of our team here. They help us decide which directions we're going in, but they also provide a backbone of support for this organization. And they do that through their membership, through our annual fund, in so many of the ways that people support nonprofits throughout this country.
And donations. So, no one ever refuses a donation.
No, we do not. So we really do rise with the kindness and generosity of Rhode Islanders and those who recognize how fantastic our stories are and how complex they are.
So walk us through some of the museums in Rhode Island and some of the 16th century, 17th century sites.
So our 16th century sites are really going to be hard to come by in terms of, I mean, our land is our 16th century sites, right? So 1500s, this is Narragansett country. We are here on Narragansett land, and that is the story of the peoples who populated this land before European settlement came. There were European trading that was happening along the eastern seaboard for a very long time before the 17th century arrival in a more permanent way of the what we call kind of colonial settler movement As people came down from Massachusetts and Plymouth, as we know, we are a bastion for those who were seeking refuge from
Religious
the
freedom.
I mean, they were seeking religious freedom. I know we often talk about the Puritans having come and founded Boston for religious freedom, but they were really seeking religious freedom to practice religion that they wanted, not to allow everybody to. And so Rhode Island was a little bit different in that settlement, but we are very lucky to have our national memorial, the Roger Williams National Memorial, where you can really get a more in-depth look into what that meant for Williams and those who followed him down after his banishment in 1636.
You mentioned the 1500s, and I think if I remember reading correctly, the colony was first named Rhode Island by a Dutch trader, right? Adrian Block, way back then. What does that name mean, and why did he call the state Red Island?
So there are many theories about why the state has its name. And so that's just one of them. So it's one of the great mysteries of the state is it Rhode Island? Is it that red that he saw in the soil and the rocks, the iron that would have been present that would have looked particularly red at a sunset when you're coming in the bay and seeing Block Island? Some people have said that it's actually was map makers and they saw Block Island and it reminded them of the shape of the Isle of Rhodes. And so Rhode Island came about that way. So at this point, from what I've seen, it's still speculation about how Rhode Island got its name in the first place.
Interesting. Well, many people know the story when the Narragansetts greeted Roger Williams, as he crossed the Seekonk River. They said, "What cheer, Netop?" Is that like a 17th century version of, "Hey, what's up, friend?"
Pretty much. It was being used by sailors at that period too. So they are using natop, the word for friend. What cheer, meaning what's going on? What has passed? What's the good news? So what cheer, natop, using the Narragansett or the Algonquin languages that are spoken up and down the eastern seaboard in New England and the Northeast. So it's that merging of the common parlance of the English-speaking sailors and the indigenous languages of this place.
So what cheer transformed into what's up?
Pretty much. But
Thanks
we're
for
really
joining us.
glad that's not what anyone said.
No, nothing. Thanks for listening to Rhode Island's Amazing Women, now a podcast available on all your favorite streaming services, Apple, Amazon, Spotify, iHeart. I'm Deborah Giro. Karen Kay is our producer, and my guest is Morgan Greff, the executive director from the Rhode Island Historical Society since 2005. What's up with the squirrel as a logo representing the society? I mean, I know you said you gathered a lot of items for later use, kind of like a squirrel, and hopefully you're remembering where you're putting those items, unlike some squirrels.
Well, the squirrel has a couple of origins, but for us, if any of you have ever been to the John Brown House Museum and you've gone into what was often known as the formal front parlor, if you look up over the fireplace that was put in for John Brown, we don't know if it was at his behest or someone else in the family, but there was a beautiful mahogany squirrel carved and placed over his fireplace. And then, if you look carefully around at this 18th century wallpaper block printed in Paris, you'll notice that there are squirrels all throughout this paper. And so, for many of us at the Rhode Island Historical Society, that squirrel sort of became an unofficial mascot. And so we were using it graphically in different items. And when I became executive director, I had been director of education at the society. And when I became executive director in 2011, we undertook a kind of community assessment. How are we known? How are we recognized? And we said, you know, we think that this squirrel really represents who we are in terms of that squirreling things away for history, that kind of collecting. And you know, a squirrel's brain actually expands in size as it's hiding all of its nuts for it to find later. And it's quite an amazing animal. And so we have both the precedence of having it at the John Brown House, but again, really liking the busyness of our squirrel.
Well said. I know you lecture a lot, Morgan, about Rhode Island social and cultural history. And one of your publications that I mentioned at the onset was How Rhode Island's Lively Experiment Helped Chart the American Way. Tell us about that and how perspicacious for Rhode Island PBS, right, to name their political show a lively experiment.
Right. Rhode Island really loved that lively experiment language that was first seen in our 1663 charter. And, Rhode Island was always different. Rhode Island is always the shaded column in the textbook. We were always doing things our own way. And when Roger Williams came down from the other colonies, he brought with him a lot of different ideas about how to put together a colony and a government. And he had that verified within the parliament because remember, England is in the midst of this great civil unrest and then ultimately a civil war. And so when they have to go back, and he goes back in the 1650s, he goes to England, he's there for years with John Clark. So it's a duo. And John Clark stays and is the one who's able to ultimately secure our 1663 Royal Charter. That charter says that it is allowing us to conduct this lively experiment. And that lively experiment encompasses things like religious freedom. And, Roger Williams in that parliamentary patent back in the 1640s, he had made sure that that parliamentary patent was only about civil concerns. So it didn't say specifically the kind of language that is in the charter, but it says this is only about civil matters. This is not about religious. So that's implied. And so in 1663, they're really seeking an explicit experiment around allowing people to worship as they so choose. They're articulating rights that are very broad. They are also, because they have this religious freedom, they are also not tithing. They are not asking Rhode Islanders to support a state or colony church. And historians like William McLaughlin have speculated that this means that the capital that people are accumulating in trade, they're allowed to obtain more of that money, keep more of that money because it's not going to the state, and invest in more. So it creates this highly speculative economic environment in Rhode Island. So you've got these very, what we think of as American ideals that are religious freedom, direct a form of democracy, a representative democracy, but Williams is articulating, and then later Clark, right, that when a government is not meeting the needs of its people, the people have the right to address that and the need to address that.
So it certainly did chart the American way and the
Right.
separation of church and state as well.
Church and state, as well as this sort of
Interesting.
early nascent forms of capital accumulation. It led to some really negative things as well as some really positive things.
I'd like to just kind of bring it into today because there's been so much discussion, as you know, around affordable housing, and for good reason. I've done a number of interviews, a number of shows with different folks, and I kind of want to dive into the historical significance of the three-deckers that sprouted all across New England and certainly here in Rhode Island back in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. I think by 1910, 7 out of 10 Providence residents were foreign born, right? Many families lived walking distance to their factory and jobs. It certainly made economic sense as people lived, with family members. They saved money. So why is it unlikely, that we won't see triple deckers today? And what happened? What's the demise of these, I call them three family homes, right? Because it
Right.
mostly were family members.
The triple decker was, as you say, I mean, it is kind of the quintessential New England house form in many ways. It's throughout all of our urban environments, and it really does become the kind of urban housing. So factory housing looks a little bit different. You often have duplexes, brick houses, or work or like boarding houses, the way you get up in Lowell. But in places like Providence and Woonsocket and Pawtucket, right, workers are often moving from factory to factory. So they want to be walking distance to a number of different options. A family might have people working in six or seven different factories. So you don't need to be adjacent to one, you need to be accessible to many. And we're really talking about cities that are based on walking and streetcars. So you also have a really robust public transportation system that is that is burgeoning alongside these triple deckers, right? So they're building close together and they're building three stories. And as you say, this is a great space for people who come in. Mm-hmm. You're able to save the money to buy one. You're able to then make money off of rents. Oftentimes families are keeping these as generational homes and sources of wealth. As we know, home ownership is so fundamental in.
And it becomes quite a generational wealth.
Exactly. And so the problem becomes that many reformers under the guise of progressivism dislike these houses in that they don't like that people who are unrelated are living in such close proximity.
Mm.
Sometimes a family might let out a room to someone who's coming from the home country, right? So they're coming over, it's somebody's, their cousin's friend, and he needs a room. And the reformers are saying, wait, this is not enough privacy for women, for children. They also don't like that so many people are doing peace work in their homes. They're saying that's dangerous, you shouldn't do that. And so you have a lot of reformers who begin, especially in the early 20th century, when there's so much immigration, mm-hmm. pushing back against these triple deckers as basically symbols of immigration. So a lot of the anti-immigration sentiment is tied up in an anti-triple decker sentiment.
Interesting.
And with the coming of the flu, the pandemic, people use that further to say, see, it's unsafe as well. Germs are being spread too rapidly through these areas with too many people and not enough fresh air. And so that's when you start to see conversations about banning triple deckers from being built in our urban environment. Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, or parts of Rhode Island, all ultimately passed laws against the construction of three family houses.
And I guess too, now with regulations, it would be considered commercial property.
Exactly, which raises the bar for fire suppression systems. And so that starts to become cost prohibitive for small building holders to manage. And so we have had, of course, the growth of knowledge about the danger of different buildings. We see this around access to two forms of egress, but we also, in a three family or more, it starts to demand different forms of fire safety.
Mm. So what kind of artifacts or letters or postcards do you have from the past that sort of tell these kinds of stories?
One of the great things about our collections, we have a tremendous amount of business records, but we also have nearly 200,000 photographs in our collections, many of which are scrapbooks, family photos, personal photos. We have a vast diary collection of men's and women's diaries, and we even online have them sorted. So you could look for them by year, by ethnicity, but also by ease of readability.
Wow.
Many folks don't know how to read cursive that well anymore, and our students aren't all learning it. Mm. And so we want to make sure people know how to access these. We have family records, family letters from people ranging from, again, Roger Williams, all the way up to maybe your neighbor participated in stuff or has their love letters as part of our collection.
And I just want to remind our listeners that the website is rihs.org. That's the Rhode Island Historical Society, because as you talk about these great artifacts, people may want to log on and check them out, right?
And we would love to see everyone at our research center as well. So we have many things online, but so much more when you're able to come in person.
Mm, absolutely. You know, you mentioned earlier, you work a lot with the schools. Are schools teaching Rhode Island history? I remember growing up and going, you know, I grew up in Lincoln, Rhode Island, and I took a Rhode Island history course. I'll never forget, in fifth or sixth grade. And I might even still have the notes because I just found it so profound, you know? I don't know if we do that anymore.
But there's been some movement away from that for a long time. And we really left it up to each district to determine when and how they wished to teach American history, Rhode Island history in particular. There's been things called grade span and grade level expectations, but I'm really happy to say that in 2023, they were able to endorse the new and revised standards for social studies for the entire state. Mm-hmm. So this is really exciting because it means that students can now move from district to district, and we can be guaranteed that they're going to get access to great material, comprehensive coverage of American history, but an opportunity to also learn about their local community and their state. So this is that was a very, very wonderful addition to our repertoire.
Totally. So you have so much knowledge about Rhode Island, but you're not from Rhode Island. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Pine Barrens in southern New Jersey. So not too far from Philadelphia, the exact midpoint between Philadelphia and Atlantic City.
I mentioned you have a PhD in American civilization from Brown, and you also have a BA and a master's from the University of Pennsylvania. Did you always know, Morgan, that you would study and work in the field of American history and culture?
You know, for me, what I fell in love with first were museums. And this is something we know. When young people have great experiences in museums, they are much more likely to become museum goers for the rest of their lives. And my parents always took me to museums. We often went on free Sundays because my father was a high school history art teacher. And my mom was able to stay home to take care of us. And that meant we had to find affordable ways to go out there and experience this. And Philadelphia had a lot of options. And so I went with them all the time. But in sixth grade, I went on a guided tour with the education staff at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And what happened that day and what I saw, I came home and I said, this is what I want to do. And then when I was a little older, I fell in love with American history.
You know, you make a good point. As a family trying to do something together that's educational and affordable, certainly, you know, museums and whatnot. So if someone's listening, obviously they are listening right now, but if they want to visit Rhode Island and or they're new to the area, what are some of the must-see historical and cultural sites in the state that you would recommend?
Oh, I mean, there's so many. I mean, you could divide up your day by time periods, by topic, and you can go online to a roadie site and find out what many more of them are. But the Tahmacquag Museum is an incredible and growing resource for our community. You can go down to Newport and see so much in terms of Newport Historical Society, but the Preservation Society, the Restoration Foundation, and places like the Redwood. And I feel, I know that I'm leaving everything out, you know, some of these wonderful sites, but in every local community, there are so many great resources. I think about places like the Little Compton Historical Right. Society, which will have exhibits and resources, not just about their community, but how it fits within our nation and our world, that I just love. And of course, we've got Slater Mill, now part of the National Park Service, that tells the story of industrialization and connects our sites, both at the John Brown House and our Museum of Working Culture. Slater Mill really plays a pivotal role in between those two sites.
Absolutely.
And so the great thing about Rhode Island is if you have access to a vehicle, but even some other ways, you can get around the state and you can see history at just about every turn.
And I'm glad you mentioned the Museum of Working Culture, one of my favorites up in Woonsocket. And
thank
the
you.
Website, by the way, for the Rhode Island Historical Society is rihs.org. My guest, Morgan Greff, Executive Director of the Rhode Island Historical Society, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my joy. I'm Deborah Giro. You know, I end each show with a quote, and this one is from American poet Robert Penn Warren. Historical sense and poet sense should not be contradictory. If poetry is the little myth we make, then history is the big myth we live. And through our living, we're constantly remaking history. So true. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Rhode Island's Amazing Women. I'm Deborah Giro. The podcast is available on all your favorite streaming apps. Until we meet again, thank you and stay well.